Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back on this Tuesday, as again we head into the Thanksgiving weekend here in Brooklyn, as Penn State basketball gets ready to play this evening in the championship game of the Legends Classic. But it's also a time to think about great holiday gifts. This might be one, one of those great table books, Lair of the Lion, written by Lee Stout and Harry West. And gentlemen, I welcome you to the Sunbury Motors Studio. It's great to have you here. And Harry, what opened the door for you to get interested in a project like this?
Well, it all started with a course that I taught on the history of structures. Okay. And we started with Stonehenge and went to modern structures, but tucked in there was a lecture on the Beaver Stadium because it's interesting, it's big, and it has a lot of challenging structural problems. And this sort of morphed in then to something student groups wanted and town groups wanted. My son said at one point, "Dad, you ought to write a book." And I said, "No, I don't think anybody's interested in the structure." But then Lee and I got talking at the gym one day and thought about how we could bring the structural part into the history of sports venues and Penn State planning and so forth. And that was the beginning of it.
Well, I believe the place is seven different structures, isn't it?
Oh, it's glued together in many ways.
I mean, I think it's seven different structures.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a book unto itself, Harry.
Well, my son said, you're a Brooklyn Dodger fan, Dad. He said, people always read things about the Brooklyn Dodgers. It's the same with Beaver Stadium. But right. I didn't believe him until I got together with Lee and thought we could put this together in a different way.
Well, I'm about 10 days away from going to the Barclays Center, which is where the Brooklyn Nets play. I'm going to do two games there. What's interesting about that spot is that was the spot that they chose for the new Ebbets Field, and the Brooklyn Council said no.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always thought that to be interesting. Now they've got this place. Lee, what about your part? Now the history part. This goes back to you with archives for years over at the library. Mm-hmm. So then you brought that part in.
Yeah. When Harry talked to me about the possibility of doing something with the history of stadium and of the stadium and how we might expand that, I immediately thought of all the wonderful books there are about the history of Penn State football, going back to Ridge Riley and Rappaport and Lou Prado and all the many other sports writers that have written about that. And I said, well, gosh, they don't need another one of those from somebody who really doesn't know a lot about Penn State football other than having watched it since 1965. But I thought, well, if we could fit the history of the stadium as a venue – and the sport that was played there, and actually multiple sports, into the history of the university, how it fits, and then how the game has evolved, how the game at Beaver Field and Beaver Stadium has evolved, and how the fans' experience has evolved, that could make an interesting book.
Well, Joe Paterno told Rip Engel when they moved Beaver Field over to the east end of campus that would be the ruination of Penn State football as we know it.
Yeah.
What turned it into, obviously the winning football was a big part of it, but what turned the venue into an event area as more than just being a football stadium?
I think that that the location, when you quoted Joe as saying this would be the biggest mistake that they ever made for Penn State football, he was talking about the fact that it was being moved out into a pasture.
Right.
East Halls, for all intents and purposes, didn't even exist at that point.
Right.
The Shields building, this kind of central location of all those administrative functions didn't exist at that point. There was pasture and there were some barns and corn cribs and so forth. But they had the wisdom to see that as – The attendance was increasing as the number of students and number of alumni were increasing, that more and more people wanted to come see Penn State football. They were improving the road system so people could get here. And they were experiencing something that they didn't have at New Beaver Field, where most people walked to the game.
Right.
Now more people were going to drive to the game. They didn't have parking back in the center of campus for this. So this would be good not only because they would have an unlimited possibility of expansion if Penn State did well and more people wanted to come, but also they'd be able to park a lot of cars there.
Yeah.
And that opened up a space for a lot of additional purposes besides football and track.
In fact, I can tell everybody, I think Beaver Stadium of the Big Ten easily has the best parking situation even now with 110,000 seats. The jacking up of the seats, taking out the track, jacking up of the seats, putting the concrete in at the bottom. Harry, structurally, how innovative was that plan to do that back in, what, 76, 77?
Very innovative. In fact, it had never been done before. Nothing like that's ever been done since. And that was by far the most challenging expansion because they couldn't begin it until the end of the 77 season. They had to have it finished by the beginning of the 78 season, yeah. And it's a mammoth undertaking. And I went to Harrisburg and interviewed the gentleman who was the foreman of the job at the time, and he said it was the most challenging job he ever had. They had a strike on campus, which kept his workers out. They had bad weather, and he said they were putting the hardware in the locker room doors the night before the first game.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it was by far the most challenging problem he ever had.
Who came up with that idea? I mean, you're sitting there, the track's there. Now, today, what they do today is, like, take Ohio State, Michigan State. They've lowered the field. They've taken the track out, they've lowered the field, and that's how they've done that. They didn't do this here. Who came up with the idea of, like, let's jack it up a section at a time and then build it?
Well, I'm not sure who came up with the idea. I know that Michael Baker Firm was the one then. They actually thought about lowering the field as one of the possibilities, but were concerned about drainage problems and things of that nature. But Clarence Knudsen, who was a person with Michael Baker at the time, said it was the only time it had ever been done. And I think who actually gets credit for originating the idea, I don't know. But it was certainly novel.
Well, it's remarkable.
It's remarkable. It really is.
I mean that was done 40 years ago.
Yes.
I mean, my goodness, 40 years, and it stood the test of time. What did you find out in this, Lee, that you didn't know before?
I would say I knew about the moves from Old Beaver Field to New Beaver Field to Beaver Stadium. One of the things that really struck me when we were first talking about the move from New Beaver Field to Beaver Stadium, I knew they had taken the grandstands apart and trucked them out there. But what I sort of never noticed was that they had built, 16,000 new seats.
Yeah.
But they were up in the air, and the old grandstands were fit in below them. And I remember first time seeing a picture of all these stands up in the air and thinking, wait a minute, what's going on there? And that's when it struck me that, even this was an innovative idea. And if it hadn't been for the type of grandstand that had been used beginning in 1934 when they started to switch over to steel from wood, it would have been impossible. I was just at the Ohio State game and spent a fair amount of time looking at the grandstand and the construction, and it's pretty much all concrete.
Yeah.
Penn State had actually talked about that beginning in the 1930s of building a permanent stadium about where the bus station is today,
right.
Eventually abandon it. They couldn't afford it in the 30s, and they didn't have time to think about it in the 40s. And by the time the 50s came along, they'd already expanded New Beaver Field in 1949 to a horseshoe.
Right.
And at that point, they realized they couldn't expand it anymore. It just wouldn't fit.
Yeah.
So moving in 59 was really the only option they had. It would have been much more difficult, much more expensive if they hadn't had the kind of steel stands that they did.
Right. When it rains, you can see the 30,000 seats. I've been in there. As you know, I've been in there more than most people have, scrimmages, things like that. And if you sit in the press box and it rains, you can see where the 30,000 seats are. Just enough coloration difference where you can see where it is. It's interesting. Yeah, very interesting.
Some of the images that you catch over the years are interesting when you see they replaced the wood benches with aluminum.
Yeah,
that took place over about a 10-year period. And some of the images show brown and aluminum colors, you know, at different sections of the stadium.
How challenging was it putting the scoreboards on there? Let me step back one second. How challenging was it to fix the north deck once that was built? Because there were cracks in the concrete.
Well, it was very challenging. I mean, that of the 12 concrete vents that radiate out, 8 of them had cracks.
Right, and this is a cantilever deck, so it's not attached to the rest of the stadium.
That's right. It's not attached in any way. It's anchored on this large reinforced concrete vents, and the cracks were at the interface between the corbels, which supported the pedestrian rampway, and the frame itself. And you know, there were all kinds of arguments about whether the forms were taken off too early or inadequately reinforced and so forth, but again, they looked at several possibilities, and the one they came up with was this post-tensioning,
right,
which basically closed the cracks and prevented additional cracks from developing. And timing was a big problem because they already had 10,000 seats sold for the Cincinnati game.
Right.
But it was a very challenging thing, and I think the solution is a good solution. It's a little bit unattractive and raises a lot of questions, but it's very effective.
Harry, the stadium's in 7 parts. There's a lot of parts of it.
it doesn't. It's not an attractive structure.
Yeah. No.
Although people will challenge you when you say that.
Oh, yeah.
The real fans think it's beautiful.
It's our
wonderful
place.
Yeah.
This is our place. What the heck? You know?
Inside, it looks beautiful.
Absolutely.
When it has 110,000 students.
Absolutely. And when one guy's going 69 yards for a touchdown in the second play of the game, it looks awesome. Lee, track the success of Penn State football with the size of the stadium. I mean, does one dovetail the other, in your opinion?
Actually, pretty much it does, I think. I like to go back to the beginnings of Penn State football, maybe because there's nobody alive to contradict me.
On the lawn? On the lawn with Bucknell?
On the lawn, but, you know, by 1893, they had a football field and a grandstand.
About 500 seats, maybe?
Something like that, yeah. They did have showers, though. They brought water down from Ag Hill and set up showers under the grandstand. So, you know, all the comforts that you would want.
Yes.
But, you know, by that point, they were playing teams like Bucknell and Dickinson. Yeah. As success increased, they began to play more regional opponents. They eventually began to play Army and Navy. And then got into
1912, went out to Ohio State, and Ohio State quit.
Yeah. And they got into playing the Ivy League schools, which was the SEC of its day.
Right.
They were the national champions repeatedly. They had most of the All-American players, so Harvard, Yale, Penn, and Princeton were the big opponents. If Penn State could tie Harvard, it was you know, reason for a major celebration. But as the team improved, the stadium, the number of people who wanted to come increased. They added more and more wooden grandstands. Now, the big change came in 1930 when President Hetzel decided they were going to de-emphasize football.
Yeah, people realize in the 30s, when you look at the records, like, wow, the records weren't very good.
What happened? There's because 9 straight losing seasons.
They said they de-emphasized football.
Yeah, And it wasn't just the number of seats decreased because they took down some of the wooden stands. They began to build steel, but very slowly, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 seats at a year. But they were playing fewer games. They were playing lesser opponents, and they weren't having very much success. By 1939, 1940, 41, they were beginning to turn it around, but then the war came in, messed everything up, And it wasn't until the veterans started to come back and you had that 47 team that went to the Cotton Bowl.
Right.
That was really kind of the turning point. From that point on, things began to improve.
Right.
But I think the expansion of Beaver Stadium can be pretty easily traced with the success. I think it was really hand in glove.
Right. Yeah, I agree. The hand, because there's more demand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. More people want to go and see it. Where have your respective seats been over the years? And how often have you changed, if at all?
Well, I mean, starting as a student, back when Beaver Stadium was a horseshoe, we sat pretty close to the round part of the horseshoe.
Yeah.
That was where the freshmen sat, and then gradually, as you went up, you moved up a section each year. After when I was a grad student and really faculty member, we'd scavenge and get seats wherever we could.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they weren't very good. When I really began to buy season tickets, we were very fortunate. We had friends who had tickets that they shared with us, and mm-hmm. sitting on the 45-yard line, and that was really nice.
Yeah.
And then recently, I've been sat in the north end zone for a while. We were under the deck, so we were dry and
brilliant
games. But now we're in WH. So
very nice. What about you, Harry?
Well, as a student, my first game here was in 1953 when they had the snowstorm.
Oh, okay.
I came from New Jersey as a senior in high school, and that was my first game, the 1953 Fordham game. And then as a student, of course, my years were entirely at Beaver Field. And I've never had season tickets.
Really?
I go to games on occasion as I can. And today, at age 81, I spend my game in front of a flat screen.
Ah, I'm not. That's very comfortable.
Yeah,
it is. I don't like to admit that, but that's the case.
Nothing wrong with that. You paid your dues. Okay, you paid your dues. Saturday's going to be 26, so enjoy your flat screen.
Please don't say that.
It gets warmer during the game.
They need two layers of long underwear.
No wind. Oh, it's okay. When I did the Ohio State game, it was, 34 there? There's no heat in the booth.
No.
I'm like, oh, that's great. I said, I'm enjoying this. It's a lot of fun. I mentioned the scoreboard before. They've had, obviously, variations of it. There was one, the standalone scoreboard that was there in the late 60s into the early 70s, still an expansion. Then, obviously, the more intricate boards have been put up, and now you get the video boards. Any challenge in putting those up based on the structure?
Well, the big challenge, they did that in the 99-2001 expansion.
Yeah.
The one on the north deck is separately supported. It's not supported on the deck itself. They actually had to weave a supporting structure up through the pedestrian rampway to support that, because the deck wasn't designed to support it.
Are any of the seats attached here? No, I'm just kidding.
And then of course when the south expansion was done, they designed it from the beginning to support the scoreboard.
But right. That's a building. That is a building.
Yeah.
I mean, the south end. So.
Oh, it is. In fact, one of our chapters in the book is when Beaver Stadium became a building.
Yeah.
And because just talk to Bobby White.
Yeah.
And you'll find out that these sayings that nothing else happens there but seven games a year, he can contradict that in a hurry.
Right. Absolutely. And it's also changed the game a bit by having it there, because as all of us know, before the building was put up on the south end, this was a north to south wind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember 1978, Penn State kicked off to start the game because Pitt wanted to receive, and Penn State had the option in the second half, and Joe kicked off again because of the wind, because he knew Pitt couldn't move. They won the game. He knew they could not throw the ball into the wind. He kicked off twice in the game.
It may be unprecedented.
It might be, but some knucklehead remembers it.
Yeah.
We're joined by Lee Stout and Harry West, Dr. Harry West, and they collaborated on the book Lair of the Lion. This is really the story and the history of Beaver Stadium, which, of course, we've all loved and enjoyed for decades. Some going back to when it was Beaver Field And a lot of this as to what Lee has been able to uncover dates back to the early days. There's a lot of Penn State football history in this book. And Harry, of course, doing a brilliant job on the engineering part of it, because we've always kidded about it being an erector set. Well, it is. It's separate parts sort of connected. So we got one more half hour with the two of them. It's great to have you with us. Penn State basketball coming up this evening in the Legends Classic Championship game here in Brooklyn. Looking forward to that. One more half hour to go here on the show today. Of course, Penn State beat Pitt last night to get there, and thus they're in the championship game, off to a 5-0 start. All right, coming up, more with Lee Stout and Dr. Harry West. We're brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motors Ford knows it's the holiday season,
and you need a dependable vehicle, but also need as much money left in your pocket as possible. Let's be honest. If somebody gives you way too much for your piece of junk trade or cash just for buying a car, who do you think is paying for it?
You are!
Come see why SMC has been selling more cars and satisfying more customers since 1915. Pick from over 100 2017 Ford F-Series trucks. Priced as low as $24,997. Choose from 42 2017 four-wheel drive Escapes, slashed as low as $19,975. At SMC, take $3,500 off all remaining 2017 Ford Explorers and get 0% financing for up to 72 months. Don't believe everyone else's hype. Sunbury Motors always gives you huge discounts, aggressive trade values, and the best financing options. And with over four city blocks of new Fords, they have what you're looking for. Sunbury Motors Ford, in the 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Final half hour of the show. Great to have you with us. Leading into the Legends Championship game at the Barclays Center this evening after the Nittany Lions knocked off Pitt last night. Very pleased to be joined here in the Sunbury Motors Studio by Lee Stout and Dr. Harry West, who co-wrote Lair of the Lion. First half hour, of course, fascinating. Enjoyed it. We're keeping them for the entire hour. And if you missed anything, a fascinating journey that these two have taken to put this book together, Lair of the Lion, which I think would be a great gift for the holidays. I'll start with Harry, then we'll go to you, Lee, when it comes to this. And, of course, all this is brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And that deals with sourcing. How deep did the Rolodex get, and who are some of the key individuals that really opened the door for what we're able to read in this book?
Well, when I was developing the course, Herb Schmidt was still the associate athletic director, and he was a good friend, and he provided a lot of material. In fact, many of the images that I have, I got from Herb. I went up there, and he gave me a plastic bag with slides, and I was able to select the images that I wanted. And Herb has always been a great source because he grew up with it. He knew everything about it. And then, of course, there are other people along the way, too, but Herb would be the one that I would. And then we checked with the construction people and the physical plant people. And I was amazed to find in physical plant I could go back and get the drawings for the 1934 Lambert Grandstand. It was the first steel structure that was in the New Beaver Field location.
Wow.
And I was able to trace that whole development and the expansion in the various years in the 30s. And then the addition of the horseshoe in 49, which in addition to the horseshoe, they extended the grandstand in the southerly direction, 72 feet beyond the end zones. So all of that was available through physical plant for the drawings that they had archived there.
What about you, Lee, in terms of sourcing?
Well, my sources were, you know, largely the archives.
Right.
Having spent
you have access there, Lee?
Yeah, I'm a researcher today.
Yes.
I'm not allowed behind the scenes, but it was I'd known from years of helping other people do research,
right,
including Ron Smith, who was a frequent visitor to the archives. That You know, we had a lot of photographs. We had all of the programs going back to the 1920s, to the Beaver Field Pictorials, as they were called then, the alumni magazines, the media guides going back to the late 50s. So there was lots and lots of source material available that way. Over the years, we at one point back in the 1980s, I think, we acquired the negative collection of the old Bob Breon Penn State Photoshop. And right. he had served not only as the photographer for LaVie, but also as kind of the college's unofficial photographer. And he had put together an enormous archive, and they were mostly negatives. So we printed a lot of them. And then we had a committee of guys come in and spend afternoons identifying these pictures. And in our acknowledgments, I'm talking about people like Tiny McMahon and Jack Sherry and a variety of other people, Carl Stravinsky, old Letterman, and veterans who would come in and help us identify who the individuals were, who the players and coaches were. And I got, over the years, I got to interview a variety of people, including Rosie Greer, and talked to Wally Triplett. Charlie Way was probably the most interesting person because
in 1920.
Yeah, because he had he had come in. He was so small that Coach Bezdek didn't even want to let him play.
Right.
And finally, they had a back who was hurt, and they had to put Charlie Way in. And he scored, I think, 3 touchdowns in his first game. And after that, his nickname was Gangway because he could go. And he also talked about playing professional football. He played for the Pottstown Maroons and a few other teams where he got paid like $50 for a game or something like that. And but he was, he talked about playing football at Penn State in the 1920s, and it was just an amazing thing. So those are the, and of course I've known many of the administrators in athletics. We became the archives for sports information and had all of their back files and back photo files. And when TCS was doing the television, we ended up with all of their video. So there was quite a lot of material to work with.
Yeah, last time I talked to Charlie Way was in Cincinnati many years ago.
Yeah.
He was fascinating.
It was.
Fascinating. I think, Harry Lighthorse Wilson was on that team with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back in that era. Dexter Very, maybe close to that area era.
About that. And I think Charlie Way missed out on being the All-American back that year. There was a guy named George Gipp, who got the designation as the All-American back and shut out Charlie Way.
Could have been Ronald Reagan playing the Charlie Way story.
Yeah.
Playing the Charlie Way story. And then Jack Sherry not only played football, but he was on the Final Four basketball team in 54.
Right, with Jesse Arnell.
With Jesse Arnell, the two of them both. Well, because a lot of guys doubled up back in that era playing both football and basketball during that particular time. You have to take a break? Well, then we'll take a break. I'm going to keep you guys around a little bit longer.
Sure.
Harry charges by the hour anyway. No, I'm just kidding.
But first, he has a professional fee structure. I just do it.
You just do it for the fun, Lee.
Yeah.
Lee Stout, Harry West joining us, the book Lair of the Lion, talking about Beaver Stadium, not only as a center of events, because, Penn State football is more than a game, it's an event, and also as a structure, which is remarkable. The track was in there for a long time. As Harry pointed out earlier, they took that out to then put the stands in there, but just talk about the fact that the track was in there and the various events that were in there over time.
Well, if you look at the overhead view of New Beaver Field, you can see all the various, pits and so forth for various track events, and those were carried over to the stadium when it moved there. And it continued to be a dual one. In fact, when they put the temporary bleachers on the south end, when they would take them out in the off season because they were wood. But when they put in a light steel, they actually could run under it for a period of time. And then when they, in 1980, I think it was when they put in the, or maybe 76, when they put in the permanent steel bleachers, that's when they had to go to a new track facility. But it was where all the track events were for many, many years. And even the original Beaver Field, behind where the Osmond Lab is today, that was originally for track and baseball and tennis, and all that was part of that facility.
Also, way ahead of the curve when they did the expansion in the 80s was to put permanent lights in. Today, I still go to stadiums, and if there's a night game, some have permanent lights, others need, quote, must-go lighting, which they truck in. What did that mean to the growth of the program? And also with an idea to the TV era, Lee, that they have permanent lights.
I think it made a tremendous difference. There was a couple years where they brought in temporary lights for the occasional night game. But after the NCAA lost the antitrust case in, what was that, about 84, I think.
84, Oklahoma, Georgia.
Yeah, that just broke open the whole opportunity for TV beyond what the NCAA had controlled, when Penn State might get one TV game a year, possibly two. And it made it possible for things eventually like the Big Ten Network, for Notre Dame to have its own network. Penn State had delayed television in a small network sort of run through TCS in Pittsburgh.
Nelson Goldberg.
Yeah, Nelson Goldberg. And it just really opened everything up. So, you know, with lights came increased opportunities for broadcasting and increased opportunities for night games, or at least lighting up the stadium for a late afternoon game when it gets really dreary, as it often does here in Happy Valley.
And I wouldn't tell James Franklin that.
I'm just speaking weather-wise.
This is where Joe Paterno, being on the College Football Association committee, working hand-in-hand with Chuck Nienas, paid great dividends for Penn State, because he was there. Because people don't realize that before the Oklahoma-Georgia thing broke, the CFA actually put together a contract with the NBC, which I think opened the door to, like, hey, look, we got to challenge this, because the NCAA didn't want it. And that he understood they needed to put lights in because he saw the TV thing taking off.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it came down to. I asked before anything that surprised you along the way, what was the most interesting story you feel like you told in this story that really captured your interest more than anything else?
I guess I'd probably go back to the early days.
Really?
I think people in general don't appreciate, and I don't really think that I had appreciated all that much, how much football was a true student activity then.
Right.
The faculty and administration almost completely hands-off. It was the students through their athletic association, which started 1887, 88, that began to field teams in various sports. The two people who were really in charge was the captain of the team, of Penn State's 11 for football. He was the one who selected the players. He called the plays. He did oversee some of the training and practices, and then the manager. I mean, today we think of managers as these poor guys that are cleaning uniforms and, you know, prying the turf out of face masks. But in those days, the manager was just as important as the captain, because it was the manager who handled the money and who arranged away games and who went around panhandling to get the money to provide a guarantee for teams to come here. And in those days, it was really hard to get a team to come here because it was so isolated.
You had to take the train to Lewistown and come in from there, right?
Actually, in the 1887, you could take a train right to State College.
Okay.
But nevertheless, it was
do that now.
It was a long, it was an hour trip just to get from Bellefonte to State College by train.
In fact, there's one game against Pitt that was played in Bellefonte.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, because it was hard to get from Bellefonte to State College.
So they played it up there.
Yeah. In those early seasons, there might only be one or two home games in a season, and the rest would be away games, or there would be games played in a neutral field. A lot of schools in those days liked to have a game in a city because they could really attract a big crowd then. And Ivy League schools especially, you know, they'd play at the Polo Grounds in New York, and they would have 40,000 people attend a game.
Right. And Penn State forever, when they played Pitt, would be playing at Forbes Field.
Yep.
I mean, over and over.
Yep.
One of the big surprises for me was in the early steel structure.
Okay.
In the archives that I found at the physical plant was that there was a patented grandstand, a Lambert grandstand. It was actually patented by the head of civil engineering at the University of Iowa. Mm-hmm. And you could piece these things together both horizontally and vertically because it's not like the typical bleachers where you can fall through or drop things through.
Right.
And in all the subsequent additions to the stadium, at the new Beaver Field location, they were all credited to this patent that was the so-called Lambert grandstand. And it wasn't until the new expansion came when they didn't have to patent that anymore, but they copied that style. In the addition of the 16,000 seats when they expanded to the new location.
Right.
And it wasn't until that the north wing was put in that they followed the same idea, but they no longer had the same kind of patching together piece by piece.
It's down the road, years down the road, and the design certainly has an opportunity to change and so forth based on what is at the moment. But I assume the two of you took at least a look at the model of what it could look like down the road. What did the two of you think of that when you saw that this past summer?
Well, I was a little surprised when of course, there was all this publicity about renovate versus restore. But to a large extent, it's not renovation. It's replacement in place. Mm-hmm. Because three-fourths of the stadium, at least the way it was presented at the meeting, will be replaced over time.
Right.
And one of the things that I was kind of unaware of is the fact that, you know, you see on the east and west side now, you see some chairs, back chairs.
Right, yeah. They replaced those, yeah.
They replaced. And but when I examined that closely, they changed the tread for those seats. Because the existing stadium only has, I think, 27-inch tread.
Right.
And you need 33 inches to have seats. And I didn't realize that they actually changed the decking so that they could put those seats in because they have the space that you need there. But it would not be possible to replace throughout the entire stadium because you don't have the tread length that you need. I was a little surprised that the plan calls for taking down the east suites. I mean, the only thing that would be retained would be the southern part of the structure, and the east, west, and north would be replaced one section at a time, and that would include taking down the elevated three-story building, which is the luxury suites now.
Right.
But that seems to be, of course, it's 5 years down the road. A lot of things can happen.
Sure. That was my point in the question.
It's conceptual at this point.
Right.
But that seems to be the direction that they're taking.
Right. That was the point I made in the question. Is that, look, it can all change. I mean, but it's just at least a starting point. What did you think?
Well, when they first, you know, talked about starting this master planning study, and they said, well, we're going to look at the renovation or replacement of Beaver Stadium. And that's the first time anybody had ever talked about replacing Beaver Stadium. And, of course, it was like a volcanic eruption among alumni. Yeah. Like, my gosh, you can't replace Beaver Stadium.
I do a dozen speaking engagements every year. I got it.
You heard about it.
I may have heard it once or twice. Yeah.
Immediately we began to think of, well, you know, A, where would you put it? Because you couldn't tear down Beaver Stadium and build a new one in between two seasons.
Right.
If you could resolve that, how much would it cost? And, of course, new stadiums in cities for professional football, baseball are, you know, they're not just – $300-400 million. You're up in the $1 billion range.
Yeah, Yankee Stadium when Penn State played the Pinstripe Bowl is a $1.5 billion structure.
And those can't be built without enormous amounts of local government investment and bonds and so forth. You know, Penn State's not going to get that. Tremendous reliance on not just gate receipts, but boxes and dogs and and parking. It's going to take a tremendous amount of fundraising.
Other stadiums that the two of you have been to, which ones have fascinated you? Besides here, other places you've been to, you went, what about you, Harry? Lee, I mean.
Well, I have been to Ebbets Field.
Ooh.
And that was 55. You know, Snyder, Pee Wee Reese, Roy Campanella.
They won the World Series that year.
That's exactly right. To my father, who was a Yankees fan. But that was a You know, I think I've been to the stadiums like Three Rivers Stadium,
Bush Stadium, Rivet,
giant multi-purpose bowls indistinguishable and undistinguished. Ohio Stadium was a very interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't go to a lot of bowl games or away games, sure. I thought that was really pretty fascinating.
Game was at Ebbets Field in 1947 with Jackie Robinson.
Wow.
And I was a kid then, 10 or 11 years old. One of the first experiences I had was at Fenway Park, sitting behind them.
Yeah, yeah, they still exist, Harry.
Yeah, they do.
I've probably been to 50 to 100 games at Fenway Park. I've been behind every column.
I did graduate work at the University of Illinois, and that's a classic Memorial Stadium.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And, I mean, it's old, but it's classic, and they've renovated it a good bit now. But mm-hmm. when I was there as a student, I was impressed with that back in the 60s.
Well, we're impressed by the book, Lair of the Lion. Great gift for the holidays coming up, by the way. Lee, Harry, thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed this thoroughly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
What a fascinating hour. An absolutely fascinating hour. I think I could have gone 2 more hours with these guys. Harry, Lee, thanks so much. Appreciate it very, very much joining us here in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Again, the book is Lair of the Lion. And it's more than just the history of Beaver Stadium. A lot of it's intertwined with the history of Penn State football and the history of Penn State itself. And, we'll see what it's going to be like down the road as to what Beaver Stadium is going to look like, say, 10 years from now. But that's a fascinating look. And with the holidays coming up, that might be a great book for the Penn Stater in your family. Lair of the Lion, Lee Stout and Dr. Harry West. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Coming up, Legends Classic, Penn State in the championship game this evening here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.